Branch NMLS number 33041. Rick Rittman's NMLS number 664589. Equal housing lender. Some restrictions apply.
Welcome to Indy's Real Estate Gurus, brought to you by Advisors Mortgage Group and Fix-It Mortgage. Our branch NMLS is 33041. Now, here's your host, the hard-working mortgage guy, Rick Rickma.
You know, I'm really into cars. I love cars. My office is full of car paraphernalia. And one of my heroes as I was growing up, and still is, it was Mario Andretti. I love Mario. He just was a phenomenal driver and a great person. And Mario once said that I think it is counterproductive in many ways to pretend to know things you don't. You surround yourself with people who are the real experts. In my life, I have found that that is a very true statement. You surround yourself with experts. And today, I have two real expert gurus. Greg Keel is joining us. Greg is a private wealth advisor and managing partner of
Acuitas.
Acuitas.
You're getting closer every time.
Acuitas, a financial group. And anybody who can spell that, send me an email. That'd be great. It's not just me. He's a private wealth, or has a private wealth advisor practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc. Greg has a bachelor's degree in both economics and political science and has earned the certified financial planner, chartered retirement planning counselor, certified divorce financial analyst, and certification for long-term care designations. Greg has served proudly as a captain in the United States Army and served a combat tour in Iraq. Greg also has over 22 years experience as a financial advisor. He doesn't look old enough to have that. He has earned numerous awards and honors and leads a team of 22 advisors and staff. Greg's firm specializes in helping people recover from the trauma of divorce through compassionate, sustainable financial planning and litigation. Additionally, his firm provides advisory services focused on executive compensation, estate, and retirement planning. And I can tell you from the people that I have worked with that have worked with Greg that everybody thinks very highly of him, and he is a gorilla of financial planning. And Greg, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks, Rick. Great to be back, and that was quite an introduction. Appreciate it, sir.
I'm working every time to come up with something better.
That was impressive.
I'm not sure how I get to follow that.
That's going to be tough.
And Greg, what is the best way for listeners to contact you if they have financial planning needs?
You can Google us at gregkeel.com, GREGGKEELE, or gregkeel.com, 317-288-5400 is our phone number.
And along with Greg, we have Rob Shive, attorney at law. Rob blends a full litigation practice and substantial involvement in mediation, arbitration, parenting coordination, and collaborative law while maintaining a primary practice of high asset, high conflict family law cases. Rob also practices general civil litigation, criminal defense, and business law. I probably didn't pronounce defense correct. I can mispronounce everything.
Well, it depends if you're saying it or if you're chanting it. It's defense, right, at the Lucas Oil Stadium.
That's correct.
See?
Yeah, see, that's my problem. This breadth of experience provides Rob with the background to handle complicated legal matters from a variety of angles and seeks the best possible approach for his clients. Having represented radio and television stations, internet businesses, local restaurants, national corporations, scientific laboratories, real estate developers, and other commercial enterprises, he brings that experience into complicated divorce disputes and custody battles. Rob is also a registered civil and domestic mediator, having successfully mediated divorce actions, paternity cases, modifications, contempt actions, international custody disputes. I mean, these are very interesting. Property division, real estate litigation, and construction cases. As part of the movement towards out-of-court resolution, Rob is also a family law arbitrator, parenting coordinator, and is trained as a collaborative law professional. Rob has been listed as a super lawyer since 2014 in the area of family law. Rob, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. What is a super lawyer? What is?
That's a designation by one of the companies that seeks peer review.
Okay.
And your peers vote you, I believe it's, I think the statistic is the top 3% in a particular area. Each state has its set of super lawyers, so. My firm is blessed to have several, actually, people who make that list annually.
And with a ticket and a Boeing jet, he can fly.
Well, it just seems like that's a huge 3%. That puts you in the top 3% of but they consider attorneys in Indianapolis.
Well, like with any industry, it's rewarding, obviously, to please and serve the clients, but it's also nice to have the peers with whom you work and associate give you that kind of vote of confidence and of capability.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's huge. And it's something I'd never heard about, but now it would be something I would look for.
It's actually, they actually publish the list in Indianapolis Monthly when it comes out. I think it's actually in February.
Okay. Okay. So it's coming out, or is it one of the two?
It'll be one of the middle sections in there. I think it's February or March.
And what is the best way for our listeners to contact you with their legal needs?
I'm at the firm Emsweiler, Williams, Nolan, and Clark, and we're up on the north side at Keystone at the Crossing. And because Emsweiler, Williams, Nolan, and Clark is a mouthful, our website is much simpler. It's just the initials, www.ewnc-law.com. And my page is on there along with everybody else at the firm. And our phone number is 317-257-8787.
I've looked at the website, and it's really a good website. It's got a lot of great information. It's really easy to navigate, so it should be easy for people to find you.
We're simple, folks. We like our website to be something that we understand how it works, too.
Yeah. I had a client, this is a while back. Her name was Kim, and she and her husband, they had separated and both were living in the marital home. And before they filed, she was wondering if she could keep the home so that the kids would not have to move. And she was just wondering if it was possible.
Well, one of the things about dealing with issues like that, where you can rely on folks like you and like Greg, is to get that information as quickly as you can. We do a lot of mediations at my firm. My partners and I do a ton. And preparation for a mediation, although it's not the same as court, is really vital. And that's a number one circumstance that comes up a lot, is someone who wants to stay in the marital residence going forward. Well, if you come to a settlement conference or mediation or even court, the very best thing you can have in hand is a pre-approval letter, because then both sides can know, okay, this is possible. Before you get to that point, if you talk to somebody like Greg, you need to look at your finances and look at a projection of what you're looking at coming out of a divorce. And if coming out of it, whether you really, really, really love the house, but you really, really, really can't afford it, you've got to make those kinds of decisions. So really, the answer to that question is find out the answer. Look at the finances, look at the post-divorce landscape, and come into negotiations and discussions trying to figure that out. If you have good lawyers on each side, they'll have great ideas. They'll have people like Greg and you to refer to get that kind of expertise and feedback. And then you can come to the table actually being able to answer the question, how soon can I refinance? Can I refinance? Can I get cash out? And all of that's vital to trying to resolve these issues. So the sooner you know those kinds of answers, the faster you can get through the negotiation process.
Rob, could you talk about why it's so important for the spouse that's going to keep the house as part of the divorce? Why is it so important that they're able to refinance if there's a mortgage on that house?
Well, typically married couples will finance the house originally with both names on the mortgage. And once they're splitting, the person who is not keeping the house has a vested interest in how quickly their name can come off the mortgage, because with very few exceptions, you can't carry two mortgages on most people's income. Therefore, the answers to that are also a matter of not only can it happen, but in what time frame, because 6 months seems to be sort of something about showing income and things, from what I'm getting feedback from folks like you. Do we need to get those 6 months running? Do we need an income stream? Do we need payments on a mortgage from someone else? Because the person who's trying to get off the mortgage wants to know, when can they get off a mortgage? Because likely they're couch surfing or they're renting an apartment. But if you got kids, you want to get out into your own house. Well, okay, if we're getting divorced and you're going to keep the house, when? And when can I get my own mortgage? Well, if you know the answer to when I can refinance, get your name off and off you go.
So we've all had horror stories, but maybe tell us about that time or two in your career when somebody negotiated and, okay, she's going to keep the house, but for whatever reason, she couldn't refinance. Things didn't go the way they'd planned. 2 years later, she stops making mortgage payments. And right. Then what happens?
Well, I've had a couple of curiosities with this. Number one, I had a case many years ago where the parties had agreed on everything but chose not to use an attorney, which you can do, but they simply checked the boxes on the forms with regard to property. And one day she got a call from the mortgage lender saying, hey, your mortgage is 3 months behind. She had remarried, and she called her new husband and said, why haven't you been paying the mortgage? To which he said, I have been paying the mortgage. She called them back and said, we have been paying the mortgage. And he said, no, not on that house, on the house from your divorce. And she said, oh, no, my husband was taking care of that. And they said, oh, great. Send us the decree that says that and we'll put it through loss prevention. The decree didn't say that. He had no obligation to refinance the house at all. And worse yet, when we had it inspected, it was not worth, the value of the house was less than it was going to cost to bulldoze it.
Oh, oh no.
So she was stuck in an impossible position. And I ultimately, my advice to her was, stop paying me. I can't fix this. I can't make the husband take you off. He's not capable of it. And no one's going to refinance this residence. So the options I can evaluate are no options at all. Related to the other circumstance, it going back to my what we were talking about getting prepared and knowing when you can refinance and get things off. Every lawyer worth their salt is going to make sure that if you do a refinance plan in a final decree, that it has contingencies after contingencies after contingencies. Because if you can't refinance and I want my name off the house, then you got to sell it. Well, I want time frames for all those events to happen. But it would sure help me be a little more liberal in my discussions if I had a pre-approval letter in your hand that said I can refinance in 6 months, 4 months, or whatever. All those contingencies don't seem to need to be so necessary. But it's a real problem because one of the issues that you're stuck with is the fact that you can control, theoretically, what the parties do. Can't make a bank loan the money.
Yeah, that's right.
And even if everyone has the very best intentions and everyone thinks husband can refinance the house and sure doesn't seem like a problem and all that, a lot of things can happen in 6 months. And so, again, if you can know that and lock that in up front, you can save yourself from a whole lot of paragraphs of what if, what if, what if, what if, that nobody wants to have to look forward.
Right.
So important that those settlement agreements are competently written. And I know people like to save money, and that's great. But using someone like Rob, who has a ton of experience and has seen things go right and things go wrong, it's essential that settlement agreement is enforceable. And if it's not written correctly, it won't be. So great advice to your listeners, Rick. Look at that team of that attorney, that financial advisor, and Rick Ripma, to make sure that as you're going through that divorce, things will go the way you want them to go.
Yeah. And, you know, in the 6 months, some people can finance it without the 6 months. I just had a client that we're working on right now that they had, they're both financing a house, but they both work. They both have been working. The divorce is final. We don't have to wait for any child support or anything else that we have to use to qualify. But when you get somebody like you were talking about, you get somebody who hasn't worked in 4 years or even a year, and now they're getting divorced and they have no income. There's no way. You have to have an income. And then, and we also have to get back to work. And if you're going to try to finance it based on support, we've got to get a history of support. And that's where, I mean, I've had many of people who've come to me who thought they could finance after the divorce. And they said, well, I'm not responsible for that house. I'm sure you've had that. No, sure. I'm sorry. That doesn't matter. The divorce decree doesn't get rid of your obligation on the home. And it's a big problem for people. I'm glad you understand it because I've had many of people who've worked with attorneys who didn't know that. And that's a real big plus to me that you really have a great knowledge of how it works.
Well, I mean, the clearest way to explain it to people, and this happens in mediation a lot of times, is to show them the top of their divorce documents and say, it says, in the marriage of John Jones and Mary Jones, show me where the bank is in there. show me where the mortgage or the credit card or any of those other financial people, show me where they're in the title of this case. They're not. So the court can't make them do anything.
Yeah, I guess people think because the court said it, it's the law, but it's not the case.
Sure. Well, I mean, logically, that's what they're thinking, is it's an order and doesn't everybody have to follow a court's order? But you get into the whole, you know, who's really a party and who do they have jurisdiction? But what it comes down to is understanding what you're negotiating and what the ramifications are. So again, the more you know coming in, like in your example, if that person has talked to Greg and they can look at what their income would be based on what the divorce would end up, maybe he can make your job easier by saying, we're going to be able to refinance this no sooner than 12 months. Well, if you know that going into the negotiation or the mediation or even the trial, then you can apply that knowledge and you can come up with something that's going to have fewer likely pitfalls.
Yeah. And the other part that you were talking about is the pre-approval letter, which is something that, for me, I didn't know to do that for years, but I have been doing it now for quite some time. If somebody's going through, you know, they call me about, you know, they're in the midst of divorce, I get them, I qualify them, I get them a pre-approval letter. They have something to take and say, here's what we can do based on these contingencies. And I thought it was the right thing to do. It's really nice to hear you say it really helps.
Well, it's extraordinarily assisting because mediation, if you're not familiar, operates with the parties in two separate rooms. So they're not really ever together. And the mediator is sort of the emissary back and forth. And so if one room says she wants to keep the house and she can refinance it in 6 months, the other side's lawyer is going to say, are we sure that can happen? Well, if I can walk into the room and come back with a pre-approval letter from you folks that says, no problem, we have this set up and we're prepared to do closing within 60 days of the divorce being settled, et cetera, the attorney in the other room now has something in hand to say, okay, looks like we have our ducks in a row here.
Yeah, it's great to hear because I you know, you don't always hear back whether it's being effective what you're doing, but it seemed to me to be something that would be helpful, so I started doing it.
It's very, very helpful at every point in the process. Even after the divorce is final and one of the spouses is trying then to buy a new home, understanding what they can qualify for and having a pre-approval letter helps to set those expectations. Divorce is a very traumatic and emotional time for most people, and I encourage people to take a little bit of a breath and maybe even rent something for 6 months or a year and figure out what they really want. Very few people take that advice and they run out and buy the most expensive house they think they can afford. But I encourage your listeners not to do that. What I do encourage them to do is get with the most competent mortgage broker that I know of in this city after 23 years of practice, Rick Ripma, and get that pre-approval done so that you know as you go out and shop where you can and can't be in terms of prices of houses, because they are getting up there these days.
Yeah, they are. It's amazing.
Now it's time for Questions with the Gurus.
This question comes from Bob and April, who are wondering about how to prepare for long-term care if it's needed in the future. And they were thinking of themselves, but also a little bit of their parents. And they were wondering if home equity line of credit would be a good idea. Obviously, it's something they could do, but there might be better things. And I thought, Greg, this would be a perfect question for you.
Long-term care used to be pretty easily solved with a traditional long-term care insurance policy that would pay for home health care, assisted living, and God forbid we need it, nursing home care. And it used to be a couple $1,000s a year could get unlimited coverage that they could pretty much count on to cover their needs. If for some reason the insurance policy didn't and they bought a policy that was certified by the Indiana Partnership for Long-Term Care, if they exhausted the policy, again, one that qualifies, they could go on Medicaid and have the state pay for their future care without having to sacrifice any of their assets. Those days, however, the insurance companies badly mispriced those policies and they really misunderestimated, that's a George Bush statement, right? The number of people that would drop those policies, who would pay for a number of years and then stop paying, the policy would lapse, the insurance company would be off the hook, but they have all the premium. People didn't do that. They kept those policies and they used them. And so the long-term care insurance industry now is I don't think it's overstated to say it's a bit of a mess. Those policies are really expensive, in many cases, 5, 6, 7 times the premium that it would have been 10 or 15 years ago, to the point that sometimes it doesn't make sense to pay that much money to insure against a loss you may not experience and that may not amount to very much. So there's a variety of things that we can do. There are now annuities that have long-term care benefits. There's life insurance that has long-term care coverage sometimes built into them in a hybrid form. Some insurance companies will allow you to set aside some money. So maybe I give $100,000 to an insurance company and they promise to give me $300,000-$500,000 of long-term care. If I don't need the care, I get the $100,000 back in a death benefit. And if I decide I don't want it anymore, I can get my money back in the future. So if I live, if I get sick, if I die, I've got, you know, some coverage. So there, we have to be a lot more creative for those people whose parents are facing that and they're no longer insurable. There are elder law attorneys that can come up with strategies that can help minimize the impact to the family's wealth while following the law to the letter. And I would encourage them to talk to us about that, and we can look at which of those things. I wish I had that simple, easy answer like it used to be. But things have gotten out of whack, way more expensive, and way more complicated.
I like the old answer better than that one. What about you, Ron?
I like simple, but simple doesn't always work anymore, unfortunately.
And can't turn back the clock, can we? Rob, I've heard a lot about the collaborative law, and I know some of the things that you do are really interesting to me, and this is one of those. How does a collaborative law work, and you know, what are the pros and cons for somebody looking at getting divorced and thinking about that as a possibility?
Well, collaborative law is a sort of a sub-discipline that's been created, and it's starting to really gain some momentum. There are some states that require it. We don't. But it's essentially sort of a commitment. Well, not sort of. It is. It's a commitment by the parties to try to do the peaceful, organized version of a divorce. The most important part about it is it creates essentially a divorce team for the parties to operate through that gets questions answered, understanding comes much quicker, and you're looking at getting information in a common manner than either side asking for it from the other. And you seek the assistance of a financial person who could do the analysis of the pre, current, and then post-divorce situation for the parties. Each side has an attorney who's been trained in the collaborative process, and we have a great subgroup from what's called the CIACP, which I can never remember the acronym, but collaborative is one of the C's. But anyway, who has trained quite a few of us, and you commit to doing it. You tell the court you're doing it, which means the court doesn't set any hearings, and you're committing to doing this process collaboratively, literally in the term, and you get counseling people available to each of the parties. You get financial people available, and then the attorneys essentially shepherd the information being gathered with an idea that everybody's got the same things they're working from. And instead of each party trying to take the Tinker Toys and build their own model and show the court which model do you like, hopefully you're both taking the same set of Tinker Toys and building a single model. And if you do that properly, then you save money, everybody's on board, and you begin to make decisions, again, to overstate the word, collaboratively, from the idea of how you divide the assets in a manner that is most mutually beneficial. If you have one spouse, as an example, who is a fairly high income earner, then maybe they need less cash out of the dissolution to go forward and get their own house. But the other party, who has not worked in a while, needs the cash and would give up retirement assets that the other party doesn't need. Those are issues that are, in a competitive negotiative circumstance, sometimes scrape each other trying to come up with a resolution that everybody can live with. In this process, that's the analysis you're supposed to use. How do we come out of this so it's best for us? And of course, most importantly, if there's kids involved, kids.
Right. Sounds like it'd be much better for the family.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is to try to eliminate as many of the factors that cause divorce to be so scarring emotionally. Certainly, you can't erase all of them. But if from the get-go, it's a lot more about the end game and mutuality than it is who wins and who loses, you're getting rid of a whole lot of what comes out of the divorce that has to heal, that's not about checkbooks and mortgage payments.
And how does it differ from, I know you do the mediation. Is it? How does that differ?
Mediation is actually pretty much mandated in most of the courts to as a way to settle cases that are in fact contested. It's a great way to resolve them, though. It's without the full commitment that the collaborative process requires. You can actually mediate within a collaborative case as well, but hopefully you don't need that additional element. Okay. But mediation is an opportunity for people who are in contested cases to come together with the assistance of an experienced person to try to work through something. Because the most important element that people don't understand about relinquishing control of their divorce to a court is what the results can be and what your remedies are if you don't like them. Well, if you don't want to do that, you agree and let a mediator help you draft something you can all live with and you all like might be strong, but don't hate.
Okay. So it's a little like the judge, if you go to court, they take all control.
100%.
Mediator kind of still leaves you with some control.
The mediator actually can't control anything except the process. It's really the decision of the parties. But the mediator, the analysis I like to use is, if you remember Venn diagrams from statistics, the little circles and they overlap, is that we've got one circle with one person's outcome and one circle with the other person's. And the mediator's job is to push them close enough that they overlap.
Okay.
And where they overlap is a mediated agreement.
That must be a difficult thing to do.
Some are more difficult than others, but I'll tell you, to be honest with you, in 25 years of family law, I find mediation about as rewarding as anything.
Oh, really?
Because the resolution and the relief is palpable at the end of these. I mean, nobody adores a mediated order, but nobody hates it. And when you hate your divorce order, you're setting up a breeding ground for a long, long time of conflict, especially when you got kids.
And Rob is being modest in his skill set in helping people come to these agreements, because going to court is traumatic. And as you've said several times, you lose all control. And the judge has very little time to understand the nuances of the case. The judge is going to get a very little information and have to make very big, binding, permanent decisions. So avoiding that, there's ways to do that. But Rob's process of helping people come together, understanding that, hey, what I'm asking for here is not reasonable. and so a skilled mediator will come in and say, look, you're not in the reasonable zone. Over here is a reasonable zone. Not that you have to do it this way or that, but over here is a reasonable zone. And he is so good at helping people understand, you know, the direction they need to go and then helping them make good decisions. And kudos to you. It's really great work to help families get in a position to move on and heal.
Well, I appreciate that. And honestly, the process is made easier by the more folks that they have consulted coming into the mediation to get the answers in hand. Because if I can answer a question from the other room immediately with a like I said, a pre-approval letter or financial documentation, then I can help those people come together a whole heck of a lot quicker than me having to translate it in my best interpretation.
It's obvious you know exactly what you're doing, and I very much appreciate you being here. And how can I get a hold of you?
Our website is the firm's initials, which is Emslyer Williams Nolan and Clark, but ewnc-law.com, 317-257-8787. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate it. And thank you for joining us on Indy's Real Estate Gurus. If you have questions through the week, please call me at 317-672-1938. That's 317-672-1938. Or online at hardworkingmortgageguy.com. Have a great weekend.